I'm really enjoying this meeting. I'm not a physicist, but it's really fascinating to see the connections between the mathematics and physics and other areas, and I'm finding this very rewarding. Yeah, is that good? Yeah, can you? Yeah, that's probably good like that. Yeah, okay. So what I'm going to talk about today is the process of formation of territories amongst animals, and you can think about this as a pattern formation problem, if you're so inclined. Social carnivores like wolves and coyotes have very distinct and well-defined home ranges or territories. This is data which is actually quite old. It goes back to the late 70s, where I work this thing here. Here we are. Where a wolf from each of five adjacent packs was collared in May, and a radio collar was put on it. And Victor van Ballenberg, who was working on his PhD thesis, flew over this region, which is just north of Lake Superior, at randomly selected times between May and October, and found out where each of the individuals he radio collared were. And this is what we see here. This is a minimum convex polygon of the extremal locations that each of these individuals covered. And as you can see, these are really very distinct, non-overlapping areas of use. At the same time, there's a lot of communication amongst individuals, and scent marks provide important cues regarding the use of space. And this is work by primarily by Peters, snow tracking wolf scent marks in the wintertime. And there's a lot of communication about space use going on. And fortunately for us, there's scent marking in different colors on this graph. And here's a central territory. And these little lines are trails. And the red marks are associated with the central territory. And there are six adjacent territories, which have scent marks of a different color. Sorry? This is a composite. So what he'd do is he'd track behind in the wintertime and actually look for little yellow patches in the snow. It took him many years to get his PhD thesis. Fortunately, I'm not a field biologist. And it's much easier to do in the winter than the summer. And so this is actually a scent mark on a little piece of wood in a riverbed by a wolf, and if you have a dog, this may be a familiar sight. And these are very well established as being used to give indications of territorial space use. So a little bit of biology. How do canids interact spatially? Well, they typically forage by moving around a territory while searching for prey. And scent marking occurs throughout the territory. Typically, there's a bowl-shaped pattern of scent marks, like you saw in the previous slide, where the total scent mark density is about twice as high near the edge as in the middle of the territory. And there's a behavioral response to both existing and foreign scent marks. They elicit increased marking rates. And so there's this positive feedback mechanism that is in play. And movement patterns change in response to scent marks, both familiar and foreign. Also, in some wolf populations, there are observed buffer zones between wolf territories, which are infrequently visited. And so you see sometimes actually a little bit of space between territories where one doesn't get radio locations of these radio-collared wolves. This is a picture of a large pack in Isle Royale, and they've just finishing inspecting a foreign scent mark, which is just off in the corner here. And then they immediately afterwards move back into their own territory here. So there's a lot of communication going on. And one sort of interesting question from a biological point of view is, how does this communication network give rise spontaneously to patterns of territory? The kinds of data that I've mainly worked with are for coyotes. And these are coyote locations from Hanford-Aridland's ecosystem. and this is a very flat region. Basically, very similar experiments were done radio collaring coyotes, and you see their den sites are shown in with the triangles here, and we have radio locations of an individual from this pack shown in green, and from a central pack shown in red, and blue, and so on and so forth. Other data for coyotes come from the Lamar Valley in Yellowstone National Park, and you'll see a very distinct correlation of the use with the contours. So there's topography playing a role here. These are U-shaped valleys. And I can show you a picture of that here. This is Hanford Arid Lands ecosystem, and this is Lamar Valley, where you saw that last data set. I'm going to come back to, as I formulate a model, I'm going to come back to those data sets and try to understand what's going on in terms of the biology by looking at the data sets. I want to talk about classical methods for that biologists have used for trying to understand locations of individuals. Typically, what they do is fit bivariate Gaussians or some other probability density function to the location of individuals centered about their den site. And so for each, one would just do some kind of maximum likelihood fit and try to get a statistical description of what's going on. And that's not the approach we're going to use here. The objective is to formulate a mechanistic model for territorial pattern formation and maintenance, and I'm going to actually try to distinguish between these two issues based on behavioral rules for individuals, and then to test this model against radio tracking data. And I'm not going to assume the existence of territories, but see how they would arise spontaneously through behavioral interactions. I want to talk about two different kinds of models, and they really correspond to territorial pattern formation and territorial maintenance. When two wolves or canids pair bond, they go through a rapid scent marking period, and often they don't have a den site, and they start to use area and space exclusively. And then after they form a den site and they have pups, the movement is in relation to the den site as they come back and forth to the den to feed the pups. And so there's really models with no den site where one would look for the formation of patterns, and models with a den site, and in this case also with surrounding territories, where one's moving in relation to a central organizing focus. And so I was kind of interested in talking about this because some of the ideas that come up here are related to energy methods in physics. And this is the area that has been much more closely related to the radio tracking data. And if I have a little bit of extra time at the end, I don't know if I will, I'll talk about how to use game theory in this context as well. Okay, so let's first of all think about a very simple model from a biological point of view, where we look at the formation of a home range, which is basically a territory without any individuals, other territories around it, and try to come up with a mechanistic model involving the interactions between scent marking and movement behavior. And it's two very simple assumptions that we put in the model. One, that there's some positive feedback in scent marking dynamics, and so if you're near a familiar scent mark, you're more likely to mark over it. And the second is the movement rate is a decreasing function of local scent mark density. And so if you are in an area with familiar scent marks, you're more likely to spend more time there. There are a variety of different ways to formulate movement models. The simplest, probably, or the longest history is using a sort of Fokker-Planck or forward Kolmogorov approach. That's what I'll do here. Just in this case now, in one spatial dimension, you're moving on a lattice, for example, and there are many ways to derive this equation. But if you're at some point x, you'll either jump to the left or to the right or don't move with probabilities L, R, and N. And we're going to assume that you're symmetric and you're jumping. And so basically, if you see a scent mark at some location x, you're more likely to stay there, so your N would increase. So you go from a random walk approach and take a diffusion limit. And this is your Ford-Kolmogorov equation here. And we can write d as some constant d0 times 1 minus n of x and t, n of x and t being the probability of not moving if you're at a particular location. Now, if n were 1, then there'd be no movement. And if n were 0, we'd have a very simple diffusion model. And so what we do here is we assume now that n depends on the level of scent mark, and then we come up with an additional scent mark dynamics equation. And this is just a very simple caricature saturation function that goes through 0 and saturates at 1. And so as P gets very high, then D will get very small. And when we write our motility, we just use this formula to get the formula at the bottom of the page. So in a dimensionless form, what happens is when we plug in, we get this rather interesting looking PDE, where U is the density of individuals, but P now is the density of scent marks. And 1 plus P comes in the bottom here. Now we need a secondary equation that describes the production and decay of scent marks. And in a dimensionless form, the equation looks something like this. The rate of change of scent mark is some low level of production here. You have to be there to produce a scent mark. And then there's some increase in the presence of familiar scent marks. And then there's some first order decay kinetics. And you can actually go out and measure these parameters. So what about this activation or feedback function? Well, L plus M of P bar looks something like this. In the absence of any scent mark, there's some low level of marking right here, and then it'll increase with scent mark and eventually saturate. It doesn't have to be piecewise. It could be a C-infinity curve. Why do we need the P-bar here? Well, it turns out as we go forward that if we don't have some kind of local averaging in your response, in your movement, you actually get an ill-posed problem. And I will convince you of that in the next few slides. It's very much like a backwards diffusion equation. And so for simplicity, I'm just using some local spatial averaging here. And this indicates zero flux boundary conditions. And so one could ask, given this particular system here, can we look for spatial patterns that arise? I'll start with numerical solutions. Up in the top here, we start with a unimodal distribution of probability density function for the individual and no scent marks. And as time progresses, you see this table-shite-like solution that emerges flat on top and then flat on either side, with two densities appearing, one here and one here, which is lower. If we start with random initial data, this is U and this is P, we see we get a lot of kind of spike-type solutions. But if we start with the identical, same initial data, but include the spatial averaging, we get a very different solution. Again, this is time, space, and time, and space, and time, space and time there. So time goes into the board. You can see that you get behavior which is you get a couple of different sort of space use areas growing out of this. So one thing we can do is just try to understand the steady state. So if we go back to this equation here, if we set both time derivatives to be zero, and for now we're going to ignore the spatial averaging to try to get the idea of the simple behavior, we could then solve this algebraic equation for P as a function of U, and we're able to do that because of the form of M here, and plug in P of U into here. And so what do we get? We do that right here. Okay, P is a function of U. We take the second derivative of u of 1 plus p, which is f of u is equal to 0. And we integrate once, and we have the zero flux boundary conditions. We integrate again, we get u over 1 plus f of u is equal to a constant. Well, with a nonlinearity given here, this function here that equals a constant has an n shape, which is given by the curve right here. So it goes up, comes back down, and goes back up. This is a function of the nonlinearity in the feedback here. And when we choose our constant line, we could choose a number of different possibilities. We could choose it to be up here to have two intersections. We could have three intersections. The three intersections given here are sort of special in the fact that the area and above and below the curve are equal okay, but we'll come back to that. And or we could have one intersection down here. If we linearize about the central equilibrium point here, when there's no spatial averaging, we get a dispersion relation which is monotonically increasing with wave number. And so basically, if we started off with a steady state solution that was close to U2 star, we would be having something that behaved like the backward diffusion equation. The addition of the spatial averaging is regularizing that and bringing this dispersion relation back down to a negative for high wave numbers. So this sort of begs for using an energy method to try to work out what the appropriate values for the territorial and non-territorial regions are. And so we've only got this to work in the limit where the scent marking is fast, so epsilon goes to zero, and there's no spatial averaging. Okay, so clearly one needs to keep that spatial averaging in there to have a well-posed problem, but we can sort of think about the limit as sigma gets very small. And then, well, we know densities have to approach piecewise constant values asymptotically in time, and I'll show you that in a moment. And it turns out that the lowest energy solution is associated with piecewise constant solutions with values U1 star and U3 star, where one has this equal energy, equal area rule. So basically, you put your line through the N-shaped curve, and A1 must equal A2, and your piecewise constant values are U1 star and U3 star. And I will hope to convince you that in a moment. And then there, when you put the sigma back in, there's transition layers joining the two levels. And so before we go into that, if we look back, this is the kind of solution that we're seeing right here, where this would be U3 star and this would be U1 star. Okay, it's actually pretty straightforward, nothing too deep in this part. We go back to our initial problem here. This is our problem with the movement and scent marking. We look at the case quasi-steady state assumption that scent marking is fast relative to movement, and that's not always the case, but it's convenient here. And when sigma equals zero, p bar would be p, we solve and we plug into here. And so this is our equation right here. Du dt is the second derivative of some psi of u, where psi has this form here, which is the N-shaped curve. And if we define the energy to be the integral of f, where f is the antiderivative of psi, and take the time derivative of the energy, integration by parts gives that the energy is minus what turns out to be the flux squared dx. Okay, so this solution goes to a state where the flux is a constant. When we look at E, it's simple to show that it's bounded below and decreasing. In fact, because psi has an N-shaped curve, this is like a double well potential. And so this may be, I think there's a couple of interesting things before I get into this a bit further. This is a little bit like one of the talks yesterday, where when you just look at minimizing the energy, you don't have a unique solution, because all we're learning here is that we have a couple of constant values that our solution can be, but the way they're distributed in space is not uniquely determined by minimizing the energy. The other thing is that if this should be a psi here, not a phi, for any constant psi, we're going to have that E dot is equal to zero. But we can ask which is the lambda which is going to give the lowest energy. And so this is probably familiar to many people, but I just thought I'd show it graphically to try to understand what's going on. So the total energy associated with the system is now going to be the sum from 1 to 3 of the measure over which we're at a particular value, U, times the energy, okay? We're going to assume that the total measure adds to 1 because we're in a domain of size 1. And the total number of individuals needs to be conserved. because of the zero flux boundary conditions. And so we have that the sum of Li ui is equal to u0. And so if we have psi here, we just take the antiderivative and it's a double well potential. And I put in the u1 star, the u3 star, and the u2 star. And I'm going to choose a u0 that falls somewhere in the middle between u1 star and u3 star here. And then we can ask, what's the value of lambda that we'd like to have? And so this is very probably quite familiar from sort of Cahn-Hilliard type or Cahn-Allen type energy analysis. If we chose a constant that was lower here, as we drop down, we're going to get the point u and e is going to be somewhere. It's going to be a convex combination of these three points. It'll be somewhere in the interior of this triangle here. But then we have the constraint that the total density is u0, and so we draw this vertical line. And the minimum energy is the one right at the bottom there, where the vertical line intersects the lower edge of the triangle. And as we take a lambda plus above the one that gives equal area, then we get something like this. And so the one that gives equal area above and below, which gives u1 star and u3 star, is the one that just crosses over and catches the bottom of both of the wells there. And so that gives u0 and the minimum energy. And here we see we've got a convex combination of u1 star and u3 star. Okay. So that's a sort of analysis of the equal area rule in this particular context. And so we can sort of understand what goes on, at least the limit of sigma goes to 0, as being that we're getting some fraction of the population at this U3 star, which is a high level of use, and another at U1 star, which is a low level of use. Now, the full analysis of the system with epsilon non-zero hasn't been done. It would be kind of interesting, and with sigma non-zero. So there's some sort of interesting mathematical, further mathematical analysis that hasn't been done here. Okay, so, but when I go back to the biology, if we just have these two very simple elements in our model, positive feedback and scent marking and reduced movement rates near familiar scent marks, we get distinct home range patterns with a core area of use surrounded by a lower area of use. And we can predict what these densities are. But when we look at this model, it's a very simple model, and it also doesn't predict some of the field observations. Like when you saw that distribution of scent marks, there was a real bowl shape to it. Well, in the simulations and in the analysis, you see that scent marking is just the same all within the high use area. So we're not getting that. But my claim is that these should be more likely in well-established territories where there's interactions between packs. And that's been actually substantiated in the literature. So I want to focus on that a little bit more come up with a different kind of model. Okay, which is supposed to deal with movement in relation to a dendrite. And thinking of this goes back quite a long way to someone called Holgate, who thought of individuals moving via random motion plus some constant bias towards a dendrite. And so if there's a dendrite in the middle here, individuals will move randomly, and then they'll have a bias towards the central organizing area. And about a decade ago, I worked on a model, came up with a model that was sort of a modification of this, where there's two interacting packs, one density is shown here and one density is shown here. And now the movement is modulated by the interactions with foreign scent marks. And so when an individual from the first pack sees a foreign scent mark Q from the second pack, they're more likely to move back to the dendrite on the left, and vice versa. Okay, so there's some kind of separation that can occur through these interactions. Let's skip this slide, I think. I'll just move on to the PDE formulation. Well, you can collect data, right? And this is what I've been working on for quite a while, but I can talk about that a bit later if there's time. So if we just go to a simple PDE formulation, and I'm going to formulate it in 1D here, we have the local change of density is some random movement component and some directed movement, which there's advection here at some rate C sub U to the left, and that depends on the foreign scent mark density. There's a mirror image equation here, but now the advection is to the right. And this is what's going to give this sort of separation in space. And then there's the scent marking equations for both PAC1 and PAC2. The rate of change of scent mark, this deposition and decay in each of these here. And notice I haven't put any feedback in yet. I'm going to focus on the simpler model, and then I'm going to make it a bit more complicated. We need zero flux boundary conditions, and then that is going to give us that the pack size is conserved. There has to be some movement response to foreign scent marks, which we've usually taken to be linear, so there is some intrinsic bias towards the densite, which is accentuated in the presence of foreign scent marks. So one very simple thing one can do is do a steady state analysis and look for time-independent solutions that would correspond to territories. And so we want to non-dimensionalize and then solve, do basically the trick we did before. In this particular case, it's very easy. We look for time-independent solutions here and then see that the scent mark density reflects the true density of individuals. Plug it in here, look for time-independent solutions, and integrate and use the boundary conditions. And so in this particular case, which is fairly simple, but I want to go through the details of, we have our system here. And this is a dimensionless system, so some parameters have disappeared. So we have that the scent mark density truly reflects the space use density for each of these two packs. Okay, and then we plug in V here, and we plug in U here. And we integrate this. And we use the zero flux boundary conditions and get these two coupled ODEs, okay, with integral constraints. And so this is some measure of the drop-off for pack one. It's a nonlinear function of the two densities. And this is a measure of the gradient of pack two. And here I've allowed the two packs to have different parameters if they want to. And so in this very simple case, we can understand what goes on very well. If the response to foreign scent marks is zero, we just get exponential solutions that look like this for U and V. And for now, just we can ignore H. And then if we set these two terms to be zero and just look at pure territorial interactions, and in the case where the gammas are the same, we get something that looks like this. When we add in some complexity, some positive feedback in the scent marking, this is the same system, but now there is this positive feedback. We get with the same kind of positive feedback we had before, we get these bowl-shaped edges through this basically this positive feedback mechanism that says when individuals from the first pack come to the edge and mark, when individuals from the second pack come close to that location, they'll overmark, and then when individuals from the first pack come back, they will tend to overmark the overmarks and so on. And that gives, now, so you're looking at sort of the half a bowl here. And it'll actually, under certain parameter values, it'll also give you a buffer zone in the middle. So these are the qualitative features you see in a mature territory. And when you solve this in three spatial dimensions, you can get these sort of nice pictures of the interactions. Here there's a densite at this point, and this point, and this point. And the height is the density of individuals, and the color, purple being high, is the expected scent mark density. So you're getting these sort of bands of scent marks around the edges of the territories. So we actually fitted this to the Hanford Airlines ecosystem radiolocation data. So we took the PDE now in two dimensions, and we took the radiolocation data. We did a maximum likelihood fit of the solution to the PDE numerically to the radiolocation data. And what we see here are contours that show the expected density of individuals from each pack. So in the middle, we're seeing the expected density of individuals from the first pack and the green and the other colors there. Okay, this is very different than what people have done historically from a biological point of view, which is fitting these bivariate Gaussians. In fact, there's two parameters for each pack here if we take the densite as being given, because each of these Gaussians has a different shape. And in this case, it turns out we only have two parameters in our model here. One is the ratio of directed to random motion, and the other is the response to foreign scent marks. And so we have a two-parameter model that's describing what's going on. And in actual fact, it you know, you can show that it does a much better job statistically of describing what goes on. But we're not only interested in the statistical aspects. Really, we want to see if we can understand, make predictions with the model, and see if we can correlate back to behavior. So one thing we can do is to look at with that. Maybe I should go back to the, to this right here. If you focus on this point right here, where you get the three packs interacting fairly strongly, what we've got right here is the total density of foreign scent marks that an individual from the central pack sees. Okay, so this spike here corresponds to where those three packs come together. And so this is the summation of all the scent marks seen that don't come from the central pack. And so this is what's modulating the movement behavior, the bias in the movement in the central pack. And the idea is that when the scent mark density is high, there's a bias towards the densite, which is in the middle. I'm going to pick on these two points, P and Q. Lurking under this PD model is a random walk model. Basically, the idea is in the random walk, at different points in space, you have different bias towards the center. And so at some point P here, you have a kernel that describes the expected density of movements in relation to the densite in the middle. And at Q, there's a different kernel. And so what we're assuming is that on average, individuals make movement rules depending on the level of foreign scent marks, but that they're not deterministic. We can make predictions of what happens when packs are removed, because once we fit the model, we can then, you know, remove the middle pack and then see how the other packs move in to use that area. We tried fitting this very same model to the radio locations in the Lamar Valley, and it did a really bad job. And it's pretty clear what's going on here. There's a terrain involved, and so these are these big U-shaped valleys here. And the individual coyotes are moving in response to the terrain. But you can go back to the equation for movement and put in a taxis term very much like the term that Leah had this morning. And I want to show you with there's terrain taxis, right, where you're penalizing movements up hillsides. But you can also put in prey taxis, and this is what we're currently doing here also. We have the prey base, and we're putting in movement towards the prey population. So when we take the same data, the same model, and we put in terrain movement in relation to the terrain and do a maximum likelihood fit, we get these probability density functions here, which are constrained by the geometry of the system we're looking at, and which, you know, when you look at it statistically, does a much better job than the previous one. Yeah. They have the same parameter values. Yeah. So the beauty of this is there's only a couple of parameters that are used in the require. It's a little tricky. Some of the packs have different sizes, so we have to account for that. But then we assume that the behavioral parameters of each pack are identical when we do these fits. So I think here there's three parameters to the PD model. Sorry? You write it here between the blue and the green. I'm not sure why there is. I mean, clearly the model is predicting less overlap than you see with the dots. Yeah. I mean, our next thought is that maybe prey taxis will, if when we put that in, that may describe this sort of heavy overlap here between these two. And of course, along with this is the scent mark density prediction. And it predicts these high levels of scent mark between the pack interfaces. One ongoing project is, we don't have the scent marking data for Lamar Valley, but for Banff National Park, we have radio locations of wolves over a very short time period, then scent marking locations. And so really what I'd like to do is to do the same kind of thing and then predict the density of scent marks and then use that to try to validate or say there's a problem with the model. Because basically, if this model is working, it's predicting that there is a very distinct pattern of scent marks. And we know that there are these distinct patterns, but I'd like to be able to compare them quantitatively as well as qualitatively. There's all kinds of other territorial patterns that are very fascinating. This is badger territories near Oxford in Wytham Woods. And the densites are shown in black here. and there's little trails between each of the adjacent territories. And along the edge, there are these latrines, which are really just used for scent marking, that when they march along these paths and maintain these. And so it's fascinating to think about trying to take these kinds of models and apply them to new territorial pattern formation situations outside the canid world, which we haven't done yet. How am I for time? Do I have a few minutes? 5 minutes? Okay. So I'll just talk a little bit. I don't ever have a lot of time to go through this, but just to touch a little bit on the idea of putting game theory in a context here, because you know, one of the criticisms you could come up with these models are, even though they describe what happens on average when individuals move, you know, wolves and canids, all the animals that have these complex, interesting territories are actually pretty intelligent, and they're going to tend to try to maximize their fitness by modulating their behavioral parameters so as to do well. And so we were quite interested in trying to couple these kinds of models to game theory to say, how would you move or optimally if you were interacting and trying to get a prey resource. And so it turns out that actually in most locations there's just a few prey that are the primary prey for wolves. And so, for example, in Minnesota, white-tailed deer are primary prey source. And so you can couple a prey model on top of this. And so for any cumulative wolf density, you'd have some corresponding distribution of prey, which is shown by H here. I'm just going to focus on this very simple case where you have exponential drop-off or pure territorial model, and we look at these ODEs. And so there's also a very strong negative correlation between wolf density and deer density, as you can see here. The deer are shown in green and in red, and the wolf relocations are the black dots in different shapes for different packs. And so you really see these deer right along the edge of the wolf territories. And so the idea is, if we can come up with a fitness functional, then we can ask, how would you modulate your movement parameters so as to come up with an evolutionarily stable strategy? And so the idea here is that we would have your geometric growth rate, you'd have a probability of surviving, and this is through interpack altercation, there could be a mortality term, then you have offspring produced that are translated into the next generation. And so, because I don't want to run over and give a little time for questions, I just wanted to point out that when you've reduced your system to maybe a couple system of ODEs like this, which is fairly simple to analyze, even though it came from the PD originally, you can then say, I'm playing a game. Pack 1 is trying to choose its gamma U1, its gamma U2, so as to try to maximize its fitness and get all the deer it can. And the second pack is trying to do the same thing. And can we come up with what's called an evolutionarily stable strategy, which is what you'd get out of as a Nash equilibrium in a game. And so it's actually possible to do these kinds of analyses. And I won't go through that because I'd like to be able to conclude. So simple mechanistic models based on movement about a dendrite can give rise to very complex patterns. You don't need to have, it's a little bit like the last talk with the plant. You can look for very, very complicated reasons why animals may behave well like they do, but in this case you can come up with some very simple rules that on average work. You can include these models when you actually are confronted with data. There's all these new interesting mathematical problems that come up, and you need to include spatial heterogeneity such as variable terrain and spatially distributed prey. The first model I looked at was a mechanistic model with no densite. It kind of gave an idea of the original formation of the territories, but then wouldn't be valid once the densite was there. And I've got a couple data-intensive projects. Actually, just in the next month, we're putting GPS radio collars on 4 wolves in near Banff National Park that collect the location of each individual every 15 minutes for 3 months. And I have a graduate student who's volunteered to go behind and check scent marks. So I'm so excited. And intellectually, why I'm excited about this is because then we can think about the movement of an individual as a random walk. And it's getting, and we're also, there's another group measuring the prey density. And so we can think about this as sort of a modified random walk, and then try to derive the PD model from the bottom up instead of the top down, and try to see if these two methods meet in the middle. So thank you.